Olive leaf extract is an extraordinary source of the beneficial polyphenols found in olive oil and in olive plants. And now you can get all the benefits from a supplement, olive leaf extract, available through drhoffman.com. Olive leaf extract, one of my favorite supplements. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And, you know, depression is a huge problem in America. I read a statistic recently where fully one quarter of women in America are taking antidepressant drugs. I think the figure may be a little lower, but comparable for men. There are a lot of depressed and unhappy folks in this country. And our prime way of treating them is with antidepressant medication. Sometimes they are beneficial. Sometimes they're only partially beneficial. Sometimes they cause all kinds of undesirable side effects. So natural approaches to depression, that's something that I'm really into. And today we're going to talk to an expert. He is a colleague of mine here in New York City. He is a naturopathic physician. In fact, he is vice president of the New York Association of Naturopathic Physicians. He's written a great book entitled How Come They're Happy and I'm Not? The Complete Natural Program for Healing Depression for Good. Dr. Bongiorno is a graduate of naturopathic school, and he's been successfully treating patients for depression for years. He has formulated a very detailed and comprehensive plan in this book, which outlines a pathway towards natural resolution of depression. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bongiorno, who I'm going to refer to heretofore as Peter. Peter, welcome to Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's a thrill to be here. Thank you for having me.
And please reciprocate. Please call me Ron. Obviously, the main approach to treating depression in America is to prescribe medication. There are all kinds of antidepressant medications out there. They are sometimes effective. Patients are experiencing lots and lots of distress. So what's the reason not to prescribe medications? I mean, it seems sometimes, you know, following all these lifestyle changes, it's very demanding, taking a variety of supplements. It sounds like a bit of a Rube Goldberg approach to a problem which can easily be resolved with a pill. What's wrong with that?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that I'm thinking about as you say that is really the pills work, meaning the drugs work maybe about 30% of the time. You know, it was interesting because a number of years ago, the studies suggested that 70 to 80% of the time the antidepressants worked. And then a study came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in about 2005 suggesting that there are actually a number of studies that were not published which showed negative results.
Right. There seems to be what's called publication bias.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen presentations on that where, you know, let's say they do 20 studies that show that this or that or medication really works well. So maybe they'll publish 19 out of 20 of those studies. But when the studies come out negative, say there are 20 studies that show not such good results, they'll only end up publishing three. And then they deep six the studies and hide the results.
Yeah, literally hide them. And so a fellow named Fournier published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2010 a meta-analysis of all the studies. And what it suggested was that the antidepressants didn't work any better than placebo, which was really an incredible thing to think that the that these medications that people have been taking, you know, by the millions, don't really work any better than a sugar pill. So.
Right. And it'd be one thing if it was a sugar pill, because a sugar pill, well, we don't like sugar, but the pills are so small. I mean, the negative side effects of a placebo are not great, since it's basically a neutral substance. But, you know, when you if it doesn't work better than placebo, I'm all for giving a placebo.
Yeah. Yeah, and it tells us that from a conventional standpoint, we're not really barking up the whole tree. You know, neurotransmitters, which are what these drugs tend to balance and change in our brain, are a part of why we have mood issues, but are, I think are probably maybe 30% of the issue, which is why they work maybe 30% of the time, and that there are many, many other factors that are related to why we have what we call depression. You know, the word depression doesn't tell us anything about what's causing it. It just tells us a person doesn't feel good and that their mood is low. And I think the drugs are only, when appropriate, are really only addressing a part of that problem.
You know, so often I talk to patients and listeners on my radio program, and sometimes the question is, I'm taking Prozac, or I'm taking Lexapro, or I'm taking Zoloft. What can I take instead? And the idea being that people can simply substitute a natural pill for a pharmacy drug and receive sort of a panacea, magic bullet kind of effect. I think your book argues against that type of thinking.
Yes, because, you know, I think when we have to rely on a bottle, whether it's a bottle of a pharmaceutical drug or a bottle of a supplement of some sort, usually we're not getting to the underlying issue. And granted, you know, if you can get something like a tryptophan or a St. John's wort to help a person feel better, that's certainly a least toxic way to do it. But when I work with my patients, what I try to explain is what I want to do is really figure out what the underlying issues are that are contributing to the syndrome that we're calling depression, and not really just swap out a drug for a supplement and not really address the underlying causes.
And what are some of those underlying causes? I mean, you range far and wide in describing some of the main reasons why people feel poorly.
Sure. Well, there's multiple causes. Yeah, like you said in the book, I address many of them. And, you know, for example, sleep. A lot of people, before they get depressed, they have sleep problems where they're not sleeping enough, either because they have anxiety and stress and they're just not getting good sleeps, or because their lifestyle has simply brought them to a cycle where they don't think they need the sleep that they do. And so, in other words, sleep alone can be a major, major factor in why people's mood can become imbalanced. Lack of exercise. You know, every one of us needs to move our bodies every day. And when we're not well exercised, that can contribute to poor mood, can contribute to neurotransmitter imbalance, inflammation in the body, which will also cause the brain to have poor mood. So exercise is really crucial. Making sure we're getting the right nutrients and having good digestion. You know, the digestive tract is actually where most of the neurotransmitters are produced. So when people's digestion isn't healthy, that can play a strong role, as well as making sure we're getting in the nutrients that we need for a good brain and for a good body.
You know, I recently saw an article, I believe it was in Science Daily, and I actually put it up on Facebook, and a lot of people resonated with it, which is an article that states that junk food makes people feel tired and lazy, which kind of brings up an interesting issue, which is if you're too tired to prepare yourself a good meal, it may be because of the junk food you've been eating, and you're caught in a vicious cycle. And, of course, you know, tiredness and depression closely related. The tiredness, when it manifests in the brain, is low mood.
Yeah, I mean, the junk food, you know, is typically those kind of highly fried, highly processed foods, and they contain a lot of what are called advanced glycation end products, which it's an interesting acronym. The acronym is AGES, you know, and they do. They age us, and they actually bind to receptors in our digestive tract that create a lot of inflammation, which is probably the reason why we get so tired and we don't feel good. So it makes a lot of sense to me that junk food, and like you said, it's a vicious cycle. We eat the junk food. We don't feel like preparing our own food, so we eat more junk food, and it just keeps continuing on.
Become too tired and lethargic to exercise. You know, sleep quality deteriorates. I mean, this is just a vicious spiral, and it ends up with people getting placed on antidepressant drugs, which often are not accompanied by healthful lifestyle changes.
Yeah, and it's a shame because sometimes the antidepressants, when they do work, they will cover up symptoms, but they don't really allow the person to address the reason they felt that way to begin with.
Are you concerned? You know, recently there was yet another episode, a horrific episode at Fort Hood. This time, while it's under investigation, they suspect that it was not an act of terrorism. It was an instance of, quote, workplace violence from a GI returning from theater of combat with post-traumatic stress disorder, call it what you will. But anyway, he acted out on his violent impulses. But according to the records, they admit that he was being medicated. He was on psychiatric meds. Are you concerned about what appears to be an epidemic of people who, when they take these psychiatric meds, they become stone-cold killers, or they become less inhibited in terms of committing suicide?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's more and more research coming out about that. They've all but banned people underneath 18 from taking these medications unless under being severely monitored. And actually, the age has been going up and up in terms of warnings and those black box warnings about who should and shouldn't be taking it. Again, you know, they're not addressing the underlying causes. And, you know, and really, everyone who deals with psychiatry, you know, If anyone says they really understand neurotransmitters and how all these things work, my guess is they probably don't know what they're talking about. Because I think the smartest people with the most wisdom in this area really know that no one understands it.
And it's still a matter of trial and error, isn't it? You know, for psychiatrists, they say, well, let's try this, let's try that. Oh, this worked, this didn't work. You know, Wellbutrin or Lexapro or...
Yeah, it's random. You know, in 2006, I believe, there's a guy named Lividi who did a study called the STAR-D trial. And that was an interesting study because they were trying to figure out how to... patients to figure out, okay, if you take the first one, like let's say citalopram, and then that doesn't work, like what do you add on and what do you change to? And really the conclusion from that study was basically that no one could figure it out. And there's so many drugs out there. And if you want to know whether a medicine works, take a look on how many drugs there are for the same condition. And that will usually give us an idea whether these drugs are really working or not.
So you actually start the book by talking about the seven steps that are necessary, the top seven steps to healing depression. Now, I don't expect you to give them all away because then nobody would buy the book. So first step, even before you start the seven steps, buy the book, How Come They're Happy and I'm Not. But basically, what should people be looking for?
Sure. Well, the reason I wrote that early in the book is because, you know, what I've learned working with many people with depression is when you don't feel good, it's really hard to read through a whole book.
Exactly. Know? That's really true. It's like, yeah, read this self-help book. It's 300 pages long. It's like, but I keep staring at the first page and I can't get started.
Yeah, it's like, well, if I could do that, I probably wouldn't be depressed. So it's really, so I wanted something very simple and easy without a lot of explanation people can do. So, you know, the first step is really about safety. You know, there are occasions when people do need monitoring, and there are occasions where people do need medications in very severe instances. And so it's always good to check in with a physician and make sure that somebody else is, you know, taking a look and whether that's really a necessity and things are at a place like that.
So up front, you're not inalterably opposed to the use of medication. You know, some people in the complementary medicine community just say there's no place ever for medications, or they may take a Scientology orientation, thinking that this is some vast conspiracy by the pharmaceutical industry to brainwash us and mind control. You're not of that school.
No, you know, I mean, I was taught that we need to keep everything on the table and see what's best for the patient. And in most cases, I believe medications aren't a necessity, but, you know, you always want to be safe and keep everything open and see what might be best for the individual. And occasionally that might mean a medication. You know, if somebody can't even get out of bed, and let's say you have a single mom who's not taking care of her kids and isn't even taking care of herself and is in a dangerous situation, sometimes medication is the only thing you can try, because let's face it, there's these small little pills, you pop one a day, and if it can help a person get out of that downward spiral, then maybe that's appropriate, because I'm probably not going to get her to go out to you know, go to the fish store and buy some good, you know, wild salmon and cook some greens and go exercise every day. So, you know, we have to keep all options open.
Right.
My choice is to really work with the natural things to really try to heal the problem.
So you also talk about some of the tests that you should ask your healthcare practitioner to run on you, and some of them are routine tests, but others are kind of extraordinary tests. So why don't you share those with us?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in the book, I list a whole number of blood tests that I think are useful. Again, you know, depression isn't one issue. It's a whole lot of small issues that are probably coming together and causing that low mood for a particular person. So I like to look at a number of different tests. I like to look at different hormonal tests, things like thyroid, things like testosterone. I like to look at DHEA, which is another hormone that comes from the adrenal gland. Sometimes there's a system in the body called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which can get very off and throw off our circadian rhythms and throw off our stress hormones and also create a lot of inflammation in the process. So there's some tests that can look at that. I even like to look at some saliva tests to look at that further. And then there's some nutrients that I like to look at for people.
By the way, the saliva test that you like to look at, and it's one that I also like to look at in patients who are fatigued or depressed, is the salivary cortisol test. And tell us a little bit about that and what that can tell you about the nature of a person's depression.
Well, it tells us about how that, like I said, that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal system. The hypothalamus is this area in the middle of the brain where the immune system, the nervous system, and the hormonal system all kind of get together and talk to each other. And it's been shown in a lot of research that in people with depression, that system gets very off. And when that system gets out of line, then the adrenal glands typically overproduce some stress hormones or can get to the point where they start underproducing or gets dysregulated throughout the day of what stress hormones get produced when. So that salivary test can help us understand in a given day how people's stress hormones are running. And for me as a practitioner, and I'm sure you're finding the same thing, it can be very enlightening to help figure out what lifestyle changes and even what herbs and supplements can be useful to either boost someone at a certain time of day or help kind of calm them at a certain time of day. And it can be very useful for helping with sleep issues too.
Yeah, and actually there is no, of course, cardiologists have blood tests and cancer doctors have blood tests and virtually every specialty has a blood test that can help diagnose a specific problem. But in psychiatry, there is no single blood test that will tell whether a person is depressed. But the cortisol comes pretty close to helping to diagnose depression, because one of the hallmarks of depression, particularly when patients are symptomatic with sleep problems and they just feel very agitated and exhausted and achy, is this high cortisol. It seems to be pretty distinctive for certain forms of depression.
Sure. And in some cases, the thing that makes it even more confusing is sometimes the cortisol is so high for a long time that then it just drops down.
Then you crash.
Yeah, so people with depression can have very high cortisol, or they can actually have very low cortisol.
Mm-hmm.
And that cortisol is very damaging to the brain because there's an area called the limbic system in the brain, which is the seat of a lot of these emotions, and the cortisol can really beat up that part of the brain over time, and that's why people, you know, tend not only to have low mood, but they'll have a lot of fogginess, and they can't think of words, and their memory is poor, and that's typically related to that cortisol.
Yeah, and which can even be responsible for brain shrinkage that is accelerated with high levels of cortisol continuously.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, and as we're learning more with certain scans and imaging, we're starting to see that actually it does exist and is a real problem. And the beautiful thing is that that's actually changeable. You know, when you change cortisol level, like I talk about in my book, how there's studies that show how exercise can actually reverse some of the damage from excess cortisol, can actually help the brain go back to the shape it's supposed to be.
That's great. Well, you mentioned earlier inflammation as being a key factor. Can we do a blood test to determine if there's inflammation present? And then if there is, what can be done about it?
Sure. Well, there's no one perfect test for inflammation. I typically like to run things like CRP, which is C-reactive protein, homocysteine, which is related to inflammation. It's an inflammatory marker in the blood vessels. There's also something called interleukin-6, which I don't talk about in the book, but is typically very high in people who are depressed and is a sign of inflammation in the body and the brain. And when inflammation is high, usually one of the first things I think about is helping lower people's stress and figuring out what they're stressed out about, because stress can drive that middle part of the brain to contribute to the inflammatory process. The second thing that I think is very important is to bring in foods that are less inflammatory and to kind of move out some of the foods that are more pro-inflammatory. And then the third thing is to work on the digestive tract, because the digestive tract is actually where most of the immune system resides. So if you can calm the digestive tract, get the right foods in there, and bring the stress down a bit, you can really go far in lowering inflammation to the body. And that not only helps with depression, but that'll help lower the risk of heart disease, which are really just inflammation in the vessels, and it'll lower the risk of cancer, autoimmune disease, and pretty much every disease that we're worried about.
You know, in ancient medicine, it was thought that the liver played a role in depression, that excess accumulation of bile caused a person to experience some forms of depression. And in a more modern sense, we recognize the liver as a detoxification organ that is directly working in tandem with the digestive tract. And when there's toxins coming from the digestive tract that overwhelm the liver, then patients feel lousy, and in fact depressed.
Yeah, and actually the Chinese really well describe the liver in terms of emotional disorders too. And in Chinese medicine, there's liver stagnation or liver qi stagnation, and because the liver is the seat of the Chinese consider it the general for the body. It's the one, your heart spirit thinks up what to do, and then the liver carries out those orders. You know, so when there's a lot of stress and anxiety and depression sets in, that liver gets stuck and we don't go out and we don't have that motivation to do the things we love to do and want to do. And actually that brings up the good point that I find acupuncture to be very, very valuable in helping people balance and simply feel better, you know, while we're working on the underlying issues by kind of moving the energy throughout the body in a positive way.
So you as a naturopath, you invoke not just diet change, but also traditional Chinese medicine. There's also a section in your book on homeopathic remedies for depression. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, homeopathy, probably the most controversial topics in all of natural medicine is homeopathic medicine. And you know, the general idea of homeopathy is that it can help kind of balance underlying energy imbalances. And nobody really understands exactly how that works. But I have to say, it's pretty impressive. When it does work, it works beautifully. And there are certain homeopathics that have been used traditionally for depression. And really, when you use homeopathy, you take a person's case and you look at their specifics, and then you match the remedy to the person. But there are a number of different remedies that can be used. And the things I love about homeopathics, as I find them especially helpful with children and also helpful with people like seniors who are on a lot of medications. And, you know, like let's say when we don't want to use certain herbs like St. John's wort or maybe their psychiatrist is too worried about using supplements along with the drugs, homeopathics are a wonderful way that you can start to gently kind of move people in the right direction without having to worry about drug-herb interactions and things like that.
All right. This is a logical place for us to pause, as we usually do in the middle of our podcasts. So this is part one of our discussion with Dr. Peter Bongiorno, author of How Come They're Happy and I'm Not. When we return, we're going to focus on specific strategies and specific supplements that can address depression. Stay tuned for part two of our discussion with Dr. Peter Bongiorno on natural treatments for depression. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.